Chair is pleased to welcome the members and all our guests to today's meetings. The presentations today will begin with a presentation of selection models. This will be presented to us by Senator Newton with aid from other members of the Senate and also our central staff. So as Senator Newton makes his way forward, the chair will, of course, thank our sergeant-at-arms for their help today and our central staff for their work as well. With that said, we do have, I believe the senator does have a presentation that we're getting ready to be displayed on the screens here. And do members have copies? I believe that Senator Newton's office has also provided copies of most of these slides, most of these PowerPoint to the members as well. So with that, Senator Newton, we're going to recognize you for a presentation of selection models.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for being here this afternoon. In our work to date, thanks to the input of academics, lawyers, legislators, judges, and other interested stakeholders, including members of the public, we've really crystallized the characteristics of a successful judicial selection model. And a strong model has these characteristics. It evaluates judges based on merit and selects the most highly qualified candidates. It ensures accountability to the public by extension through the people's elected representatives or direct voter input or both. It balances equities among all branches of government. It limits potential for gridlock and long-term vacancies of our judiciary, in our judiciary, minimizes the influence of special interest groups and campaign donors.
Senator, if you would, we're having a little bit of technical difficulty. If you could pause for just a moment so the staff can get the screen up and going. The chair also failed to announce at the start of this meeting that it is our intent to adjourn at or before 4 o'clock today, so that members can attend another scheduled meeting. As soon as the staff tells me we're ready, we will proceed. And it's
this is on the website.
The chair would also remind those that may be listening in that the presentation Senator Newton is going to give is online and may be visited at the ncleg.net website. Without objection, we will let Senator Newton proceed, and the staff can, he seems to think that his opening remarks will be okay without the slide. So
certainly.
Please go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I want the record to reflect we got up here early to make sure we had this running smoothly. So that's life. So back to sort of the things that we have learned through input from others are important if we move to a judicial merit selection process. So we talked about minimizing the influence of special interest groups and campaign donors, encouraging broad-based diversity on the bench, and ultimately, any good model has got to balance judicial independence with accountability, and I'm going to talk more about those two overriding principles in just a moment. But for the next few minutes, I'm going to step through the four serious proposals for judicial merit selection remaining for this body's consideration. We did eliminate one model. We eliminated the Missouri model because it really fails on democratic legitimacy. There was no voter input in that model, and it fails to balance the branches of government. So we did drop that out, obviously subject to the will of this group, but we are now down to our final four. And this would be helpful if it is on the slide, but I think all the members do have this in written form. And I'm going to walk through it. So these are the first ones in particular are very simple, so I'm going to go ahead and proceed. The first model in our final four is the legislative selection model. And this is the model that is used by our neighbors in Virginia and South Carolina. And simply put, under this model, legislators pick. So that's still on our final four list. The second model, and we, when this gets up and running, we were just simply going to step through the portions of that. Let me see if I've got that in writing. I can just... It's basically nomination. Here we go. So a vacancy occurs. Step two is the people nominate or self-nominate candidates to fill the vacancy. Step three is the General Assembly appoints from among the candidates, and the judge serves for life or until mandatory retirement age of 72. That's Virginia. That's South Carolina. It's not North Carolina. The second model that still is under consideration is a federal-style appointment model. In this model, the vacancy occurs, and step two, the governor nominates a candidate for appointment to a provisional term pending confirmation. Step three would be the Senate would confirm appointment by majority vote, and step four, the judge serves for life or until mandatory retirement age of 72. At this point, I'm going to turn the microphone over to central staff because our governor at one time supported a version of this plan, and we thought that it would be helpful to everyone for central staff to give us a history of that plan.
If you would, sir, state your name for the record, and we welcome you to offer your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Gus Willis. I'm a staff attorney with the Legislative Analysis Division. You should have as part of your packet a summary. It's similar to summaries that you're used to seeing. This one's a little bit different because it's a summary of 1995 legislation. It's Senate Bill 971 from the 1995 session. And you have a summary and a flow chart behind that summary. And I'm going to just briefly go over the attributes of that judicial appointment plan. That bill applied, at least as to the appointment procedures, applied only to appellate judges. So it would be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and judges of the Court of Appeals. And the process of that basically was that there would, upon vacancy, there would be a nomination of a candidate by the governor. The governor would be able to withdraw that at any time. That nomination would be subject to confirmation by joint resolution of the General Assembly and by passage of what ultimately was, when the bill failed, was majority vote of the members voting. At one time, it was by three-fifths of each member of the House. That was ultimately between the fifth and sixth edition of the bills changed to the majority of members voting. As part of that confirmation process, the statute would have specifically allowed for the legislative committee to which the confirmation was referred to provide an evaluation of the ethical conduct, knowledge and application of the law, management of the courts over which the nominee has presided, work habits, health, and judicial demeanor. The statute also specifically gave permission upon the call of the chair of the committee handling the confirmation to inspect the files of the Judicial Standards Commission and make those records available to the committee if the committee so desired. In terms of the timing of the vote, if the General Assembly was in session, the vote must be held on the confirmation within 60 calendar days of the nomination. When the General Assembly was not in regular session, the governor would have had the ability to call a special session, which more or less would have lasted no more than 2 days specific to that issue, and that would be the only thing that could have been considered during that special session. Assuming that that nomination was confirmed by the General Assembly, that person would have a term of office that would extend through June 30th after the next statewide election for members of the General Assembly that occurred 18 months after the nomination was confirmed, in order to give that person a body of work to run on before they would have to stand for a retention election. If that justice or judge wished to continue their service beyond that point, they would be required or would have been required to file a notice with the State Board of Elections by noon on the first business day of July in the year of that election. The retention election would have been a nonpartisan election that would have been placed at the top of the ballot. Notwithstanding any other issues, whether they be partisan or nonpartisan, that retention election question would be at the top of the ballot. Upon the majority of the votes cast on that issue of retention, the regular term of the justice or judge would be 8 years. If the voters failed to approve the retention of that candidate, the vacancy would be filled by nomination and confirmation as initially it occurred, nomination by the governor, confirmation by the General Assembly under those same procedures. However, the governor would only be able to nominate a candidate of the same political party of the judge or justice who was failed to be retained. The bill also provides for transition provisions in moving from the current system of elections to that appointment procedure, and essentially that would have extended the term of any judge or justice that was elected prior to January 1st, 1996, for a term that extended beyond January 1st, 1996. They would extend that term through June 30th of the year following the eighth year that they would have been last elected. So it would have kept essentially an eight-year term, maybe extending that a bit more. And there was a provision for judges that had been appointed that could potentially extend those a little bit longer. But that was provided for in this bill. The bill passed the Senate on July 6th of 1995, but failed to pass second reading in the House of Representatives on July 27th, 1995. And staff is available for any questions that you may have on that process.
Senator Newton, you have the floor to continue, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Willis. And for members of the committee, this is not about the details necessarily of that bill. Just wanted to give you that overview of what this body had considered in the past. So the third option for consideration is exactly where we are today. It's elections. No change in where we are today, and that's the third model for consideration. The fourth model I do want to spend a little time on, and that is what we call the balanced plan, or affectionately known as the purple plan. And again, sorry we don't have this on the screen for those of you who do not have this in written form, but it is on the website. Hopefully you can pull that up on your phone. But so our quest in this committee, and we all share this desire, and that is, if we're going to change the judicial selection method here in North Carolina, we want the best method. We want the best method possible, and so our endeavor has been to choose the best attributes of all the models we've seen and do our best to formulate something that really is going to ensure a strong judiciary in North Carolina for decades to come. The overarching consideration in trying to do that is this balance between independence and accountability. And let me take a moment to sort of define or explain further independence and accountability in this context. Independence for our judiciary means independence from influence from any source. For example, the executive and legislative branches of government and special interests, which could occur if there were frequent campaigning involved in keeping the seat. So we want judges to be able to serve their purpose, their calling, independent of outside influence. What independence does not mean, and the Brennan Center for Justice explained this to us, it does not mean that it is without accountability. Independence does not mean illegitimacy. That's the word I was looking for. And that could occur, illegitimacy. So independence can become illegitimacy if it's not counterbalanced with accountability. So what are we talking about in accountability with the judiciary? We're talking about accountability to the citizens of North Carolina to fulfill the role of the judiciary as intended and prescribed by our Constitution. That's what we're looking for. But accountability, again, if it's out of balance, can be so extreme as to unduly impinge on independence. And we heard loud and clear from our judges that they want stability and they want predictability. And we want to be able to attract and retain great judges in our state. So this balance plan that I'm about to step through attempts to not only balance judicial independence and accountability, but we've also tried to maximize public input, public participation, and appropriately balance the roles of the other two branches of government. So let me step through the balanced model, or the balanced plan. First of all, again, like every other plan, a vacancy occurs. Step two, the people nominate or candidates self-nominate to fill the vacancy. So the first two steps, public participation is there, and there's complete independence. People self-select or they're encouraged to run. The other two branches of government have nothing to do with that. Step three, and this is where we try to bring in the balance of independence even further is a nonpartisan 7 or 9 member independent merit selection commission appointed by the Chief Justice to staggered terms to evaluate all nominees for statewide judicial openings. So we're talking about, at this juncture, statewide judicial openings. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court appoints an independent commission to evaluate nominees. Local independent merit selection commissions would evaluate nominees for superior and district court judgeships. The commissions, and this is really important to understand, the commissions are simply rating potential judges as qualified or not qualified at this time. So you'll have a pool of candidates. The independent, nonpartisan selection committee will say qualified or not qualified. Then the Merit Selection Committee will forward all qualified nominees to the General Assembly for further consideration. So you got independence, you got a nonpartisan commission, and you got transparency, which I think we've heard people would like to see. So step four in this process would involve the General Assembly reviewing only qualified nominees submitted by the Independent Merit Selection Committee and forwarding at least 3 nominees that they consider best qualified to the governor for consideration. So here you have the beginnings of accountability to the voters, in that if the voters do not like the nominees the General Assembly is sending to the governor, we run for office every 2 years and we can get booted out. In fact, we're accountable twice as fast as the governor, if you will, in this process. But then the governor, the next step is the governor reviews the qualified nominees that have been submitted by the General Assembly and appoints the nominee he or she considers most qualified to serve for a provisional judicial term. So here we now have, in this process, in this balanced plan, executive branch involvement. He or she gets the final decision on the candidate, and you have accountability in the sense that the governor is elected every 4 years. Then the final step is, at the second general election following the governor's appointment, the people vote to confirm or reject the judge after a, and fill in the blank here, we currently have, for discussion purposes, a 10-year term. We got a lot of discussion the first time we presented this as to whether that was the right amount of time, should it be longer. Wide open to great suggestions on that, but right now we have for a 10-year term, so it would effectively amount to at least a 12-year term up to a 14-year term that they would serve. And then again, for accountability, we would, under this plan as currently written, subject to the will of this group, we have that judge then no longer eligible after, call it 12 or 14 years, for that same level of the judiciary. They can move down, they can move up, or they can move out. But they would be term limited at that point. But we want a term long enough for there to be judicial independence and for this to be attractive for judges to participate in. So you got public participation in this last step, in that there's a vote. You've got accountability for the judges because they can get voted in or out, and you at the second general election, and you have independence determined by the length of the term that those judges can serve. So, Mr. Chairman, that is a presentation of the four models that we're continuing to consider at this point, subject to other great ideas, and I will be happy to yield for any questions.
Members, we're going to see if there are questions for Senator Newton. The chair saw Representative Jackson's hand. Are there for a question, Representative Jackson, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Newton, I'm going to ask you, I have several questions, but I'll ask them one by one. Go through the chair. You began your presentation by saying we eliminated the Missouri model. And so my first question is, who's the we, and is this committee going to be allowed to consider the Missouri model?
Well, to answer, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
To answer your second question, absolutely, we can consider the Missouri model again. We is a collective we. I don't think there's any support. We have not heard any real support for that model, and it has graded out very poorly nationally in terms of the quality of judges that have been attracted under that model. That's my understanding, but we're happy to reconsider it if you think it's important to do so.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
before you do, Representative Jackson, just to be clear, because it might put the response in context a bit more, part of what Senator Newton was trying to do is to get the House committee informed of the same things that the Senate committee had discussed. And I think what he said was the Missouri plan didn't receive very favorable feedback when the Senate considered it. I think that's the point that he was trying to make, and the chair should have explained that when he began his presentation. But you do have the floor for an additional question.
Thank you. Senator Newton, you referred to the first set of slides, the legislative appointments, as I thought being based on Virginia and South Carolina. And I just wanted to clarify a few things. I don't believe in either of those states the judges actually serve for life. And so I was wondering, is it supposed to be the Virginia and South Carolina model, or is it supposed to be someone's idea of what a legislative model could look like for us to consider?
Please. Yeah, it's based on Virginia and South Carolina. It wasn't intended to mirror it verbatim.
Okay. And then a follow-up question.
The gentleman's recognized.
You know, on the balanced model, which I believe you refer to as the purple plan, I like to relate this to I always tell people, you know, they ask you how you got to office, and I always say the governor appointed me. And factually, that is accurate, because the statute said the governor had to appoint the person that the local committee nominated. And so I was the only name submitted, and so the governor had no choice. And so my question for you is, the General Assembly is going to forward three names to the governor, can the General Assembly basically, can we refer only three Republicans to the governor for his consideration or her consideration?
No, any name. Chairman,
Senator Newton.
Any name at that point would have been vetted by an independent, nonpartisan merit selection committee, and they would have been rated as qualified, and then the legislature would choose among those names. And whether they're Democrat or Republican, I can't forecast that and predict that.
Follow-up.
The gentleman is recognized for that purpose.
Well, let's say that 10 names were nominated by the commission. Is it, in fact, possible for the legislature to only forward the three Republicans to the governor?
Well, what you're getting at is the role, the accountability this legislature plays with respect to judicial selection. And we are saying in this plan there is some level of accountability. It cannot jeopardize the independence of the judiciary, but we are accountable to the voters. Judges are not, typically. Certainly once they're in office, and they're typically in office for a very long period of time. But here, I mean, what you're talking about is there any opportunity to understand the difference in judicial temperament with respect to how they view their role in the judiciary? So you may have, when this was discussed with the Brennan Center for Justice, you have judges who are strict original constructionists with respect to the Constitution, and they believe it matters what the original framers meant when they wrote those words. And you have judges who are, they believe the Constitution is malleable and it ought to change with the culture and the times. You and I may have different opinions about who would make a better judge, but I think it's this body's responsibility to understand the judge's perspective in that area.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
The gentleman so recognized.
But there would nothing be in the balanced model that you put forth, or that, not you, but that is being put forth to be considered, that would require names from both parties to be submitted from the governor.
No. Every judge that the General Assembly would be considering would be qualified.
And follow up.
The gentleman's recognized.
And if this was a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court, there would be nothing that required the three names to be geographically diverse in submitting to the governor.
Correct.
Follow up.
Gentleman's recognized.
And same thing for racially diverse or, you know, gender diverse. Is that correct?
So the goal here is to find the judges that are most meritorious, who are the very best. Now, I think that diversity is something that the merit selection committees will need to examine. So we hope that the slate that goes to the legislature will be a diverse set of candidates.
Follow-up.
The gentleman's recognized.
But there would be nothing that would require the slate coming from the legislature to, in fact, be diverse by party, race, sex, religion, geographical region, or anything of that nature.
Right. Well, the bill hasn't been written, mm-hmm. so at this point, no.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman's recognized.
You were talking about being accountable, and you mentioned that that if the legislature has selected these judges, then the legislators would be accountable. So you would be, I would be, I'm a resident of Wake County, but I would be voting on judges in Buncombe County in Asheville. I would not.
No, these are only statewide offices. Well, you could under the, if the local piece stays intact, the local merit selection committees for district and superior court judges, and one of the things this committee may decide is that we actually don't want to do that. We want to keep that those elected and keep those more local. But you're right. If that facet stays in this plan, then after the nominations, we would be voting on those. That's correct.
And I guess I'll stop with my final question, and I'll let somebody else have a chance, Mr. Chairman. It's just, aren't those judges already accountable to the actual people that are in their districts now through the voting booth, just as you and I are accountable?
I think the answer is yes to that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Are there further questions for Senator Newton on the selection models that he's presented? Representative Reeves, for a question, you're recognized.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Jackson's question, I want to make sure I was clear that when you say that the nominees would be qualified, are we saying is there a criteria that's already been set to say what that qualification would be?
No, it hasn't been set. There would be. I would imagine the merit selection committees would establish a set of criteria that they would apply to every candidate. That we haven't done that at this point, at least.
Senator McKissick and then Senator Chalwin.
Thank you, Senator Newton. I guess I have several questions. If I could be recognized, Mr. Chair, for a series of questions.
The senator is so recognized.
Senator Newton, you know, here in North Carolina, the voters are accustomed to basically having a choice of judges to vote for. So it's not as if they're used to just voting a candidate up or down as a judge. Now, from what I understand under this plan or proposal that's before us, it would not allow for candidates to run in a primary or to be nominated in some respect to run against an existing judge. Is that correct?
It is a different philosophy. The philosophy is that the public participates on the front end by nominating candidates, and they participate on the back end in terms of retaining that judge. So there would be a direct vote, and there'd be indirect participation on the front end. In between, you've got merit selection, which many, many states have. Some of them have pure merit selection, no elections. And we're really asking the question, this committee, do we want to evolve toward a more of a merit selection weighting, still involving, again, balancing here, still involving input from the public, but do we want to have more of a merit selection weighting than an election weighting in our state?
Follow-up, if I could.
The gentleman's recognized.
Simply this, Senator Newton, wouldn't it provide voters a greater choice if, even if you went through some type of selection process as you proposed, to allow for some type of an open primary, so that if there's candidates out there that like to offer themselves for office to serve as judges at the district court level, superior court level, court of appeals, what have you, that they would be able to do so?
So are you, I assume you're referring to candidates who have gone through a merit selection process and they're deemed qualified and then we have an election?
What I'm referring to is simply this. First, I think by having these local groups, and the composition of those local groups has not been clearly defined, what their makeup would be and how that would function and operate, I do have deep concern about it becoming overly politicized. I don't want to see local groups out there engaged, politicizing this process. Historically, that's been done here in North Carolina by members of the local bar, and it has not been highly politicized in most locations and most communities in the past. perhaps what you might get when you provide a variety of stakeholders here are people who might perhaps have a political agenda, are accountable to other groups or organizations in the community that want to politicize this process, which not necessarily produce what you might see in terms of selection of people that may be the best and most qualified. I mean, what you're going to have is those people, yes, being voted up or down as being qualified, and that's it.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody's proposing that. But, you talked around a lot of issues, and you could argue the most politicized approach is elections every 2 years. They've got to go fundraise. They've got to go get backers. The very lawyers that are going to be presenting before those judges are going to be asked to give donations. There's arguably nothing more politicized than that. So this tries, again, to hit that balance.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
The gentleman's recognized.
And that's simply this. Will we not be better served, perhaps, if there was built into this some type of process, if you're moving toward this type of so-called merit selection, an opportunity for any person out there who feels that they're qualified and would seek to run for a judgeship to be able to run in some type of an open primary and let the voters choose, whatever level that court may be, so that it would become perhaps, if you're moving toward this, more of a hybrid model that allows for the traditional democratization that we see in terms of voters being able to participate. Because this way, they're only voting somebody up, or they're voting them down. They don't have a choice.
Yeah. Well, they do have it. I disagree with that last comment, and I also there's a premise in your question about it being a qualified candidate. I mean, that's one of the things we're trying to address here is do you want to elect judges because they're popular, or do you want to elect judges because they are meritorious? They're going to be excellent in their jobs. So we've tried to continue to have public input, particularly on the front end. Anybody can run. And in this model, anyone can self-nominate to run for any of the judgeships. The difference being we're just going to have an independent, nonpartisan group decide whether they have the credentials to be a judge in North Carolina. And if they do, then they're on their way. If they don't, they would be deemed to be not qualified at this time. So then your question really goes to, how about those that are not qualified at this time? Don't we want to give them a chance to run for elected office? And that's a question we can address, and if that's where we want to go.
I think you've mistaken what I've suggested. I'm not suggesting that you somehow go out there and seek out unqualified candidates. I don't think there's any compelling data that's been shared with this committee at this time, nor been shared with the committee at any prior point in time, which would make a case, any type of compelling evidence, that we have widespread problems with this state with unqualified judges. I would really debate that contention and that conclusion.
Well, I'm not contending that.
Okay, but I think that it built into this model was somehow we don't have those qualified judges. What I'm saying is that we simply, if we're moving this direction, ought to allow for open primaries for people who feel they'd like to run for judge. Let the voters decide. Let the voters have that choice, not just running against that particular judge in a retention election, but voters to have a choice between various candidates that may offer themselves. Because we've seen that with that in this state, we've gotten some great judges, we've gotten diversity on our bench, and we've been able to encourage and incentivize people to offer themselves who may not want to go through a so-called merit selection process. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I take that as a comment.
That was absolutely a comment, and Senator Newton, you're not expected to respond. For questions of the presenter, Senator Chaudhry is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Newton, for this presentation, your thoughtful presentation on this. I have a series of questions to you, Mr. Chair.
We'll run those through the chair, please.
Yes. So my first question has to do with the principles that you outlined as the goal for these plans. And one of the things that you talked about is the, which I thought was very interesting, is the balance of equities between the different branches of government. And so my first question is, I guess there have been some outside observers that have argued that this plan in the end, vest too much power in the legislature as far as the appointment process. And so my question to you is, based on the fact that the legislature today sets salaries for judges, the legislature today draws and redraws judicial districts, the legislature today determines whether judges' elections are partisan or nonpartisan, my question is, how would you address or respond to the fact that ultimately the three candidates that are selected have to be approved by the legislature before those names are sent to the governor?
I would say that I think this plan does a credible job, a good job of trying to balance those equities and keeping the other two branches involved in a meaningful way, but not in an overbearing way that jeopardizes judicial independence. That said, you may disagree with that, and that's what this committee is all about. We want to hear those views, so thank you.
Just one other follow-up in this area.
The senators recognize.
I guess I was trying to envision the actual implementation of this process. So if you had the three candidates that were nominated by the Independent Nominating Commission, I mean, would we ultimately seek those three nominees to work the halls of the General Assembly to lobby and say, I am the most qualified candidate, and therefore you should recommend – well, I guess those names are being sent to the governor, so they would not have to lobby, so I'll take that back as a question. Another follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
The senator's recognized.
Just to clarify – The Merit Selection Committee would send a full slate of qualified candidates to – okay.
So I want to talk – my next question has to do with the Merit Selection Commission. So the Supreme Court justice would appoint the 7 to 9 members of the Merit Selection Commission, correct?
The way we frame this up for discussion, yes.
And the commission would also be charged – to ultimately even appoint the colleagues or even the Supreme Court justice at the highest court of the state, correct? So the commission members are responsible for making recommendations for potential candidates that would serve alongside the Supreme Court justice, correct?
That is correct. I mean, the way we've got it framed up, that's a good point.
Yeah. And I guess my question is do you believe that those commission members would be able to exercise independence given the fact that they will be, in fact, recommending colleagues that will be serving alongside the Supreme Court justice who, in fact, is the individual that's appointing these members to the commission?
Yeah. I think that points out how important it is that the Merit Selection Committee be a diverse body with a diversity of views.
Thank you. Two other follow-ups, Mr. Chair.
The senator is recognized.
Thank you. During the last committee, the final Senate Select Committee that we had, we talked about the vacancies and the importance of filling vacancies given the fact that we are not a full-time legislature. I believe based on our discussions, we estimated it may be up to 75 judges, if we're including the trial court judges, that have to be filled. Have you given any additional consideration as to how we would go about filling those vacancies, given the fact that we are not in session the whole time?
I think that's a problem we got to solve if we proceed on this. I think that one of the solutions is to cleave off the district and the Superior Court judges and treat them differently. They don't come through the legislature. Maybe they continue to be elected essentially as they are today. That's one way we might go with that. Otherwise, we do need to create a mechanism to make sure we're not holding things up.
Representative Bluss for a question.
May I ask a series?
Let's run those through the chair, but yes, you may proceed.
Is it on? Mr. Chairman, he's out of order. He should not ever get to serve on any bipartisan commission. First of all, is this envisioned only for vacancies, or is this going to take the place of filling every judicial seat in the state?
So currently it's envisioned as grandfathering those who are there today.
Mm-hmm.
So it would only begin with the next vacancy.
Okay. Another question?
The gentleman's recognized.
I'm just wondering on the General Assembly's portion, and that might be the part that bothers me the most, having been here and seen the way it works. Is that going to be, when there's three names, is that going to be like we do the Board of Governors, where ballots are handed out and we mark the ballots of the three that we choose from among the however many names are being submitted? How does the General Assembly election portion work?
Representative, you're at a level of detail we have not reached. This is conceptual for discussion, but that's a detail we haven't gotten to.
And I'm just, here's what I'm wondering. Here's my biggest worry about the General Assembly portion. Let's just suppose, because I've got to be careful having seen what I've seen. Let's suppose Democrats win a majority and Representative Jackson is the speaker. What's to stop the Democrats from holding a caucus where they're going to decide who the three are going to be? One caucus is going to decide, and Speaker Jackson goes in and hands out a list, says, here's the three I want, and someone else that's associated with him gets up and says, hey, this is going to be a public vote too, folks. What's to stop something like that from happening that would really interfere in what you're setting up as the representative of the people exercising their judgment to pick judges?
I think I would characterize your question as more of an expression of concern that might be a weakness in this plan when we get to that level of detail, and I think that's something we ought to consider when and if we get there. That's a great observation.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop, what purpose is gentlemanistic recognition?
I wonder if it'd be in order to offer a comment that might respond to that suggestion.
Let's come back to that in just a moment. Did you have an additional question, Representative Bluth? Before you proceed, if you will, members, to be clear, what the chair has asked Senator Newton to do was to present the ideas that were discussed by the Senate before us. He was asked to present broad stroke ideas about how an appointment process would look. I think the chair believes that Senator Newton has expressed that there is no written bill, that issues such as who would appoint the selection committee have not been decided. Important issues of diversity in all areas has not been discussed. That would be a part of the bill. The qualifications to serve, all that has not been discussed. He was asked by the chair to present these ideas. The role that the legislature would play has not been discussed. It may not play one, to be candid. So out of respect to our presenter, if there are technical questions of a general nature, which is what the senator is trying to present, we'll continue with those. But the chair is not going to necessarily ask Senator Newton to defend something that's not his idea when he's here at the request of the chair. So the chair saw Senator Ford's hand. Did you have a question, sir?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newton, thank you for the presentation. Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments because my question has to do with diversity. And so as you continue to bake this plan and bring it out before us, one of the things that is important to me is diversity as it relates to race, sex, age, and religion, and ensuring that our courts are reflective of the communities in which they're going to serve in. And so as we move throughout this particular process, I would ask you and the staff that you have working on this, please be mindful that we have a very diverse community in this state that deserves to be represented. And I think that is an important piece that I'm looking forward to hearing from you and the rest of this committee as we move forward.
The chair notes, and I appreciate the gentleman's comments, Speaker Jackson, for what purpose does the gentleman seek recognition?
For a further question, Senator Newton.
The gentleman is recognized for that purpose.
Thank you, Senator Newton. In this question, I think you can tell from my earlier questions, I have some issues with the partisan nature of legislative selections. But so I want to stay out of that, but I want to get to the final point about not being eligible, because I did not hear the Senate committee, so I don't know the thought about that, about not being eligible for reappointment. Because in your presentation, I heard you say several times, we want the best judges, we want the best judges, and I believe you, sir. But it seems like to me that in some levels, the best judge might be the judge who spent the last 10 years getting that experience. And, you know, I practice law now for 21 years, and I have built my practice. And if a judgeship came open under this model and I wanted to go be a judge, you know, it would be a difficult decision for me unless I was 10 years out from when I was retiring to say I'm going to give up my law firm and everything I've built to go be a judge knowing I can only do it for 8 years or 6 years or 10 years. Whatever. So I wonder, if we want the best people, why do we want to prevent them from being eligible in the next round of selection?
I think many of us share that concern. And I think the 10 years is a placeholder, and if that's not long enough, we need to modify that.
Senator Van Dyne for a question.
To ask a question.
The senator is so recognized.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Newton. You've obviously given this a lot of thought. I'm just trying to catch up with you. Step three, where we talk about a 7-9-member independent merit selection, you've acknowledged the fact that that commission needs to be diverse. But if it is appointed by a single person, albeit the Chief Justice, how do we ensure any kind of diversity?
Well, I think that would be an expectation that we express in the bill language, and there's got to be a check on that. I think that the Chief Justice is going to be capable of doing a great job with that, but if we have concerns about that, we ought to address it in the bill.
I have concerns about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Are there further questions for Senator Newton? Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know that this is much a question of the Speaker as it is perhaps to you.
The lady may state her inquiry.
Okay. I think my concern is we've established this committee with the anticipation that there needs to be some types of judicial reform, be it mapping, be it merit selection, be it merit selection everywhere or just on the label. But I seem to hear some members of the committee saying we don't need to do anything. Is that an option here, that we're not going to do anything? So we've gone to the trouble to set up this committee at the Chief Justice's recommendation, and that we may not do anything? Because I seem to be hearing a lot of people saying, don't mess with it. It's not broken.
Well, thank you for the question, Representative Stevens. The chair would only respond by saying that we've been tasked with looking into this issue. The chair cannot predict what the outcome of this effort will be. The committee, by majority vote, will decide that. Are there any further hands? The chair is not meaning to miss anyone. It's a big room. Representative Jordan for a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Newton. My question was also about the nonpartisan Independent Merit Selection Commission. The first question is, will that be set up in advance of anything, any vacancy? And then second would be these local Independent Merit Selection Commissions. They would also need to be set up in advance, I would believe, and how many people would be on those. And just, can you flesh out any more details about those? Because it seems to be a very, very important part of this purple plan.
It is, and that would be the design, sir, that, you know, we have the merit selection committees in place. And the idea of a second, more local merit selection committee for district and superior court is in recognition and acknowledgement that they will have a better finger on the pulse of local issues, and you know, it also improves accountability the more local it is. So that was the idea and why they're separate. And the idea would be that they're in place before or to deal with the next vacancy in line.
Are there further questions? Senator Sanderson for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newton, again, thank you for your presentation. And you may have answered this question, and I just missed it. Is there any kind of cap on the number of candidates that this one of these commissions can send to the General Assembly?
No cap at all, sir.
Are there further questions for this presenter? Representative Jackson for a question.
Is there a minimum they have to send? And the reason why I ask is if the legislature has to send three and the local committee only sends three, does that tie the legislature's hands?
Yeah, the way this is structured, unless there are only four that nominate or self-nominate and one is not qualified, would we ever get as few as three? The concept is we will have a broad slate of 10 or more, for example, from which we choose three.
The chair would point out, as Senator Newton is completing his remarks, the chair does not see any other hands. The chair would point out that these questions have been very good, and the chair would encourage members to write them down and to think about them. Should some sort of idea of this nature move forward, we want to make sure we incorporate all of these things into what the bill would look like. Senator McKissick for a question, sir? Or
yeah, and I guess it's an inquiry of the chair. The
gentleman may state his inquiry.
Simply this, Mr. Chair. I know we had some discussion today about this so-called purple plan, but how is it anticipated that we will reach some kind of decision or consensus as things move forward? I mean, is it envisioned that there'll be a subcommittee working on some of these issues that have been discussed, or will there be an occasion where we actually make some group decisions as a joint committee as to what is necessary to move forward in terms of merit selection, whether it is the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, or whether we exempt the local judges at District Court, Superior Court? How is it envisioned that we will move forward in a deliberative way in trying to resolve a broad variety of very legitimate issues that I've heard today from members on both sides of the aisle in this committee?
The chair would respond to your question, Senator, by saying that while the chair is aware that the Senate has been considering alternative methods of selecting judges, that this is actually the first time this joint committee has met. And so our intention today was to get, if you will, up to speed on where each other was. We're about to hear a presentation on the maps that the House had passed. So the idea would be that the input that you have is important. The input that all the members have, the public has, is important. We want to take that and to continue this conversation. We do anticipate this committee will meet again next week. We do not know, to Representative Stevens' question earlier, we may not produce a bill, but we're going to try to vet these very important things that have been discussed and make sure that should we bring forth a bill, we have brought forth the most complete bill that we can.
Thank you, Mr. Curran. One brief follow-up.
Gentleman's recognized.
And that's this. What is the anticipated timeline that I guess the chairs have in mind for us deliberating over the redistricting piece as well as the judicial selection piece? I mean, are we looking at are we looking at 6 weeks or 2 weeks or a couple of months, or what's reasonably anticipated, or is it too open to know?
I believe it's too open to know at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Chaldwin.
When follow-up, Mr. Chair. I know that the Purple Plan now was introduced a week ago. Have we received any additional comments or feedback from the various stakeholder groups on this plan?
The Chair is not aware of any feedback on the Purple Plan.
I just note I got a letter from a district court judge today with his original ideas, and it looked in part a lot like the Purple Plan here. So I think we continue to get feedback.
Senator Daniel, but I saw Senator Van Dyne's hand first. So, Senator Van Dyne.
Pardon me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Typically, when I look at solving a problem, I start with the definition of the problem. And I am wondering what problem we're trying to fix here. I really appreciated your discussion early on balancing, and I apologize, I believe the terms you used were accountability and
independence.
Okay. Are you suggesting that our current judges are not either accountable or independent?
Senator Newton, if you, with respect, if you feel inclined to respond, you can. Again, the chair believes you fulfilled what was requested of you, which is to provide these broad strokes. But if the gentleman would like to respond, you certainly recognize.
I'll just briefly,
the gentleman's recognized.
Senator Van Dyne, we heard from a variety of stakeholders early on the Senate side, as you know, and there are a variety of models around the country. So the sole purpose of this committee, I believe, is to take a fresh look to determine whether there is a better model to ensure excellence in the judiciary here in North Carolina. It's not a criticism of judges that are in place today at all.
Senator Daniel, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank Senator Newton. I think you've done a really great job in presenting this and, you know, just pointing out some of the things about this plan. But and I think Senator Van Dyne's comments sort of lead into what I was thinking as I was sitting here is that, you know, we basically have a current model for appellate judge selection that, on the one hand, it has a lot of accountability when you have an election. On the other hand, if there's a vacancy, it's probably it's probably the worst model in the United States. You have essentially one person who picks the judges in North Carolina if there's a vacancy, and games can be played with that and have been played historically. So, I mean, I think that to say that there's not problems with the current way we do things is probably inaccurate, and so I just thank Senator Newton for bringing something forward that we can look at and work towards.
Thank you. The chair sees no further hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The chair is going to move on to the next presentation. This time, the chair would like to invite Representative Burr to present map options that he has proposed and that the Senate committee has proposed. And Representative Burr, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we have PowerPoint I'll be using as we move through the presentation, but I do want to start with some numbers to begin with. And for those who have inaccurately claimed that the judicial proposals that we are discussing here today have been hurried through the legislative process, I want to bring a few numbers to your attention to think about. First is the number five. Five is the number of legislative committees that have held meetings on judicial reform and redistricting since House Bill 717 received its first hearing back in June. 25, that's the number of hours so far that the legislature has spent in official meetings discussing judicial reform and redistricting since June. 6, this is the number of additions released to date on judicial redistricting. So each edition of the bill has incorporated changes that have been proposed by members of the legislature, by judges, and by other interested parties in communities impacted by the maps. 7, that's the number of months it's been since House Bill 717 was heard in its first committee. So 7 months now, individuals have had an opportunity to propose their own ideas, their changes to the maps, and we continue to work through that. And 120, that's the number of judges that I've personally met with, and that's a conservative number of judges that I've personally met with and judicial leaders across the state concerning House Bill 717 and any potential judicial reforms that we take up moving forward. Now, I welcome any of you to name any bill that has had a more thorough vetting process than the proposals that we're here discussing today. I don't know of any, and I think hopefully we move forward, and by the time we get to a final product, I certainly think it'll be hard to touch, for any bill to touch what we have done at this point with the discussions here on this topic. But when it comes to judicial districts, for me, and I hope for all of you, the status quo isn't acceptable. Dwight D. Eisenhower was president of the United States the last time North Carolina conducted a successful statewide examination of our state's judicial system. And since those recommendations from the Bell Commission in 1958 were enacted in the early 1960s, there have been no significant statewide efforts to examine or revise our state's judicial districts. Instead, the General Assembly has sporadically made piecemeal and fragmented changes over the past 50 years, resulting in overlapping and unbalanced judicial districts and election districts. This is completely contrary to the uniform court structure developed and enacted into law in the 1950s and 60s. Now, neither the House nor the Senate judicial redistricting plans propose to change the overall structure of the judicial system or to do away with any recommendations of the Bell Commission. In fact, both plans propose we return to the uniform court structure that was developed by the Bell Commission. Based on both the structure recommended by the Bell Commission and other long-standing policies used by our state, such as election districts, the House and the Senate plans both propose long overdue and desperately needed modifications to our state's prosecutorial, district court, and superior court districts. The modifications proposed to update the framework of our judicial districts to reflect North Carolina's changing needs and growth by taking into account available resources, needed resources, population, geography, and the workload data from AOC. Now, I want to highlight a few of the problems that I've identified as a result of years of inaction when it comes to a statewide examination of our judicial districts, combined with the dozens and dozens of piecemeal changes that have been made over the last 30 or 40 years. And first, you'll find on the screen and at your desk a copy of the existing prosecutorial, district court, and superior court districts, along with the divisions layered together on one map. And as you can see from the lines and the colors, years of piecemeal changes, inconsistent policies, combined with failure to take a statewide examination of our judicial districts for nearly 60 years has led to overlapping and disorganized lines. We have an unsystematic mess that needs to be cleaned up immediately without delay. Now, the other problems that have identified and that we lay out here that are of concern are that under current law, many of the large counties have Superior Court election districts, or sub-districts as they're referred to in the statutes. Most of the existing districts have not been updated to reflect changes in population since the 1980s. And the most egregious example that you will find is Mecklenburg County. The three outdated election districts still in use for their Superior Court districts do a real disservice to many of their county residents. And I want to walk you through this here and explain the numbers. And many of you have heard this before, but I think it's important to explain why we cannot wait. So if you're looking at the map on the screen, you've got District 26C, which is the sub-district there in Mecklenburg County, stretches around most of the county. They currently, based on the 2010 census, have a population of over 466,000 residents. Mecklenburg County has a total of 7 Superior Court judges. So there's around 900,000 residents in Mecklenburg County based on the 2010 census. The 466,000 that live in District 26C elect 2 of those 7 Superior Court judges. Residents who live in District B, and you can see it sits on the east side of Mecklenburg County there, has a population And 26B has a population of little over 301, almost 302,000 residents based on the 2010 census. Those 300,000 individuals, residents in that district in 26B, get to elect three judges. And then you've got District 26A, who has a population of just over 151,000 residents based on the 2010 census. They're right in the center of Mecklenburg County, and it seems to be cut off on this screen, but if you're looking over in this direction, you'll see that district with 151,000 residents elects two judges. They elect the same number of judges in District 26A as the people in District 26C elect, even though there's three times the population in 26C. And for me, that's simply unacceptable, that more than half of Mecklenburg County's voters are being disenfranchised by these outdated numbers and the districts that have not been updated since the 1980s, when Mecklenburg's population was around 400,000. But Mecklenburg County isn't the only county that has issues with their existing election districts that haven't been updated. Another example would be Guilford County, where there are five Superior Court judges which are elected in five single-member districts. And the population in those districts vary from 62,406 residents in a district to 128,853 residents in a district. The population in Forsyth County's four Superior Court districts range from 64,590 residents to 101,546. And in the New Hanover-Pender district, the population in the three districts range from 72,774 to 102,450. Certainly numbers that need to be updated. And these outdated election districts still in use in these particular counties and others deny many urban residents and voters an equal opportunity and an equal voice in their own communities. Now, another issue that I've identified and that we've worked to correct has been the problem with the New Hanover-Pender district, which you saw back on this previous slide. If you're looking at the existing map, and you'll see it down here in the bottom left-hand corner, you can see how Pender County is split up into two districts, thus making it pretty difficult for a judge from Pender County to get elected in that district. Pender should not be split, and we should correct that injustice. Now, when it comes to resources and in terms of what we're looking at, through numerous discussions that I've had and that many of you all have had with judicial leaders, and as we've worked to examine the workload data, to me and I think to many of you, it's clear that the judicial districts don't all have the tools that they need. And our state has grown substantially, and major investments need to be made in our judicial districts. And both plans and what you have before you there is, and certainly if the senators have anything to add on their plans, I'd invite them to do that, but want to sort of walk through and compare the plans. And both of those plans propose to invest additional resources in the judicial branch. The House plan proposes nearly $9 million in investments annually in the courts after full implementation. The Senate plan looks to invest the same amount in additional resources for district and superior courts. Specifically, the House plan proposes to invest new resources in at least 27 of the 41 proposed judicial districts by adding close to a dozen new Superior Court judge seats, adding 16 additional district court judge seats, and adding over 20 additional ADAs. These investments are proposed as a result of the workload data from the office of the Administrative Office of the Court and from the meetings and hearings that we've conducted in the House. As I said earlier, both plans modify our judicial districts and update the court structure to align closer to the original intent established as a result of the recommendations of the Bell Commission. Both plans propose as well to reduce the number of divisions used for the rotation of Superior Court judges. Until 1999, North Carolina had four or fewer divisions, and in 1999, Senator Clyde Felter and Senator Cooper divided our state into eight divisions, and we're proposing to go back down and reduce that number of divisions down to five. The Constitution requires rotation of Superior Court judges across various districts within divisions, a tradition and a practice in order to maintain impartiality and continue the administration of justice free from personal influences or favoritism. This proposal will allow for better rotation of Superior Court judges by allowing more flexibility for those Superior Court judges to work with judges in establishing their rotation and their calendar by working together. An examination of the workload formula produced by the NC Office of the Courts, Administrative Office of the Court, shows that the proposed divisions with added resources in the plan will meet and exceed the minimum number of Superior Court judges needed to serve the judicial districts in each division. And this is true in both the House and Senate plan, with one exception in the Senate plan, which is the first division, which certainly if we move forward, I think is an area we can and we should address and plan to do that. Now, although these plans are very similar, there are a few places where the plans differ slightly. And I want to walk you through some of those, and you may have your House and your Senate proposed maps that are on your desk, and I believe those are online as well, Mr. Chairman. But the House plan proposes to keep and expand the use of residency districts throughout the state. Residency districts have been in place for a number of years and seem to work well in a number of the rural districts. The Senate plan proposes to eliminate the use of residency districts based off some concerns that they heard about in committee, but I believe there's some disagreement within the committee about whether or not those should be used, but I think it's an area we should discuss and determine the best course of action moving forward. Now, the plan's slightly different in how each proposes to realign the judicial election sub-districts in our urban counties. There are, and I'll touch on those a bit more in a few minutes. And now, while both plans add additional investments and resources to the judicial branch, the areas receiving the investments, there are some of those areas are slightly different, just barely, just in a handful of those judicial districts. But in terms of the election districts where there's, point out the ones that are identical and those where there's a slightly differing plan between the House and the Senate. New Hanover, Pender, and Durham County appear to be identical between the House and the Senate plans, but the Senate and the House plans are different in Wake, Guilford, Cumberland, Forsyth, Mecklenburg, and Buncombe counties. So those are some areas where, in terms of election district, this committee, should we proceed forward, are going to have to look at those differences and see how we would want to proceed. And with respect to other specific areas where there's some differences is in the actual judicial districts. The Senate plan you can see there on the right, the House plan on the left. The Senate has proposed a slightly different arrangement of the counties out east concerning Lenore, and the creation actually Senate's proposed to create an additional judicial district for Jones and Onslow, and it moves Duplin Sampson out with Lenore, creating a slightly different district there. That being one proposal that they modified from the plan that passed the House. The next change that's slightly different from the House proposal, you can see as they incorporate, the Senate has incorporated Nash County into the proposed new 9th Judicial District, and they've incorporated Vance County into the proposed 8th District there. The House had already based a change from current law to what we proposed. Warren was in the 9th. We proposed that it be moved over to the 9th. Or to the 8th district, that helps address really population, and there's a huge disparity between those two in their population, and that'll allow for really Warren County to have a little better a voice and opportunity and be served rather than be lumped in with those counties in the 9th Division or the 9th District was substantially had a substantially larger population than the 8th. And the last county I'll point or the select group of counties I'll point out where there's a difference between the House and Senate plan would be concerning Catawba County and Burke and Caldwell, and the creation of a separate judicial district there is proposed, completely separate judicial district, new district proposed by the Senate in that plan. Those are the major differences that we have, and I'm happy to discuss those in more detail, Mr. Chairman, or talk about the rationale for any specific part of the plan, but wanted to point out a couple of the differences and the similarities between the House and the Senate plan. I really think they're fairly minor, those differences that are pointed out, and if the committee so chooses to move forward in the future, I think they can be worked out in a short period of time, and both of these plans, I believe, fulfill the constitutional obligation that the General Assembly has to realign the judicial districts from time to time and the constitutional obligation to provide the judicial branch with the resources necessary for the judicial branch to more effectively and efficiently administer justice. So I'm happy to take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Representative Burr. Are there members wishing to be recognized for questions? Senator Ford is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, technical question. Looking on the website, and I don't see Representative Burr's presentation. Can we get that up?
The chair will respond, Senator Ford, that if you're looking at the website, one place that you could find it quickly would be on the Senate Select Committee's first meeting. All of his maps are on that day's meeting on the Senate Select Committee.
But the maps are on.
I also understand from staff that they'll be uploaded by the end of today to the website for the Joint Select Committee. Any other senators? Senator Blue, recognized.
Yeah, the question, Mr. Chair. Just so that I fully understand, Representative Burr, how many districts are in your proposal?
Senator Blue, you have a total of numbered districts. There's 43 overall numbered districts in the proposal.
Follow-up.
You're recognized.
How many districts were in the original bail plan that came into effect in 68, I believe it was, 67 or 68?
There were 30.
Follow-up.
You're recognized.
And over the last 50 years, you indicate that the population has shifted, various other things have changed. Most of the population has shifted to the urban areas that you are proposing to split different ways in your districts. I can name the 8 or 10 counties. So if the population has shifted to those counties that were mostly single county districts, why not revert back to the 30 districts that were in the bail plan?
Senator Blue, the proposal that I've laid out invests additional resources in many of those urban counties, adding additional superior court and district court districts. We have in current law close to, I believe there are 45 districts today. We eliminate a handful of the smaller ones, trying to bring obviously, you're never going to be able to do it. Otherwise, you'd have these massive districts out in the rural communities. But trying to bring the population numbers closer together for many of those districts and eliminate some of the smallest districts as we move forward. So, but in terms of why not go back down to 30, certainly North Carolina's population has changed dramatically since that time. Yes, you've had growth in many of the urban areas, but you have had growth in a number of rural communities and areas at that time that would have been considered rural. So you do have a need for additional resources in those areas as well, and that's not something we're proposing today to take away from any area, or that I'm not proposing to take away from any area, any of the resources that they currently have, unless there's a justifiable reason through the workload data or some other issue that's arisen to remove any resources.
Follow up.
Senator Blue, you're recognized.
So as I read it, you reduce it from 45 current districts. And I know that there's a different number in Superior Court and prosecutorial and district court districts with different iterations of them. But you reduce it from 44 districts down, 45 districts down to 44 districts. 44. Is that correct?
It's and I can get you the exact number how many there are today. I believe it's 45. It varies because, obviously, as I said, a number of changes that have really been piecemeal throughout the years. You've got a different number of Superior Court districts, a different number of District Court districts, and prosecutorial districts. So you have to go add up the A, B's, the C's, and so on and so forth there to calculate the number of current districts. But this is trying to update all that and bring it closer in line with what was proposed.
Another question.
Yeah, you may follow up.
So you, in going, dropping one district, and I don't know where the district is you dropped in the House plan, but you increase the disparity in the populations within the sub-districts and the urban areas and the districts that you've reconfigured population-wise. For example, a judge, a Superior Court judge in one of your districts that might have 150,000 people, or one that might have two Superior Court judges in a district with 150,000, 200,000 people, is as likely as not to be holding court in one of the urban counties where, once you district these, a single judge might have 200,000 people that he runs to get elected. Is that correct?
There's no constitutional requirement that a judicial district have equal populations from one to the other in terms of the actual judicial districts. I think the issue that we're trying to address are the sub-districts, the election districts that sit within a single judicial district. So Wake County, for example, or Mecklenburg County, where you've got these huge disparities in the number of voters and residents that live in each district, and that they don't have an equal, really an equal vote or an equal power of vote to help determine the number of judges. I mean, the Mecklenburg County is a primary example that you can use today. Had it not been for the Blankenship case, I have a feeling it would be even worse here in Wake County, that before it was corrected. You know, the ability there was certainly for some of the voters to select judges was very lopsided. So we're trying to correct that end of it as well with this map.
I understand what you're saying, but that's not my question. My question is, you increase the disparity in the population that elects a judge, say, in Wake County, as opposed to the population that elects two or three judges in counties where the judges come to preside in Wake County.
As I said, if you want to propose, certainly this committee has is tasked with looking at any potential judicial reforms. If you want to propose some sort of constitutional amendment that requires that all judicial districts have an equal population in them, then you certainly have the ability to lay that out. But that is not currently a requirement in the Constitution, that the existing judicial districts have an equal population from one to the other. So that was not a factor in redrawing these maps.
Other members seeking? I'm sorry, Senator.
One last question.
All right.
Did you do an analysis of the services offered within each of the existing districts, and that is the complementary services, since everybody agrees that the courts have changed over the last 50 years? An analysis of the services and the coordination within existing districts and those same services in the reconstituted districts that you've presented in your map?
Certainly, try to take a look at all of those factors and listen to judges and judicial leaders as we travel the state to get their feedback on the maps. But as you know, if there's some sort of issues, if you're talking about any of the specialty courts, perhaps, where judges are trained to deal with a drug court or a veterans court. Under the Constitution today, the chief justice can assign a district court judge to go to another district and serve there temporarily. So if there's a need to have a specialty court outside and have a particular judge go there, the Chief Justice has that ability today and would continue to under these maps.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out whether you did a systematic analysis based on some data that you could repeat and you could study, as opposed to some anecdotal approach to determining the level of services existing in current districts as opposed to those coordinated services that might exist in the districts that you propose to create.
As I said earlier, Senator Blue, we looked at the population, the available resources, needed resources. We looked at the workload analysis that came from AOC and used all of that to come up with the proposal that we developed in the House.
One final last question, Mr. Chair.
All right. I know there are several other members seeking recognition, Senator Blue, but you're recognized.
Yeah, and you mentioned the workload data, and sort of intuitively there's something that doesn't seem to make sense about that, Representative Burr. If Mecklenburg County or Wake County each have 10% of the state's population or more, I think it's greater in each of those two counties, and those two counties are the places where one would argue, I think, since they're both heavily urban counties, the prosecutors might be – prosecutors required may be greater, because one would argue that the level of criminal activity tends to increase to some degree based on the density of populations. And the complexity of the cases tried in those places might be different, because you have major corporate litigation going on in those places and extensive corporate litigation. Doesn't it intuitively suggest that 10% of the prosecutors or 10% of the judges at a minimum would be required to do the work within those counties? And I know that you're going to say that you rotate judges in because there's rotation. But you don't rotate district court judges in except under special circumstances, and you don't rotate prosecutors in. They're unique to the counties or districts where they are.
Senator Blue, as I go back to the numbers I pointed out to begin with, and in the 7 months since we first rolled out this proposal, I've been meeting with, talking with judicial leaders. Certainly there have been several counties where they have advocated for additional resources, and we've worked to plug those in and provide them with those resources where they're needed. As you know, judges aren't assigned to counties based on population. They're assigned based on need in the courtroom. And based on the workload we have available to us from AOC, based on my conversations with the judges, we work to invest additional district court judges and superior court judges in those counties where they were needed at. And I think in just about every case where one was asked to be placed, we did it, even going so far as Guilford County, who, if I'm not mistaken, we had plugged in an additional superior court judge, but they actually needed, even though workload data says that they needed another superior court judge, they, and in meeting with the superior and district court judges there in that county, they actually said, well, we need a district court judge much more than we need superior court judge. Will you swap it around for us? Will you work that out? So we've worked to try to accommodate requests like that from the judicial leaders in each of the communities around the state when they've made those requests. So if there's another request out of Wake County, certainly welcome your judges or your district attorney or you to come forward with what's needed and tell us why, and let's see if we can accommodate their needs.
Thank you, Representative Burr. One thing I miss about the House is I don't have a queue any longer, but I think the queue is getting large of members waiting to ask questions. I would note, Senator Blue, in partial response to what you're driving at, that one of the presenters we had in the Joint Senate Select, the Senate Select Committee in the first meeting was representatives of the AOC, who went through an explanation for us of of the workload formulas and why that analysis is the way it is. And I had a subsequent conversation with, I think it's Brad Fowler, if I remember the name correctly, there, who addressed one of the points you just raised, Senator Blue, about whether resources can be divvied up by per capita, and he explained why that's not true and why the workload formulas go at it a different way. It was helpful. But I think it serves as an opportunity to note that there are a lot of materials that have been accumulated on the Senate Select Committee's website in the course of the number of meetings that we've had that might answer some of your questions. And so with that, I'll recognize other members seeking to ask questions. Senator McKissick, you had sought to be recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Burr, I guess there's several questions I'd like to ask you. First is simply this. If we are about to undertake this judicial redistricting process and we're using population as the criteria, why would we not look at the entire state in doing so?
Senator McKissick, and that goes back to the Blankenship case, and I believe there might have been a presentation. I know there was a presentation on that in the House Select Committee, and I'm happy to sit down and look at that. The issue dealing with population and those numbers is a concern within those election districts within an individual judicial district. There's no requirement across the state that every judicial district have an equal number of residents in it, but there are case laws. There's a Blankenship case that raises concerns from the lawsuit that was filed 10 or so years ago or 12 years ago here in Wake County that challenged how those districts were established at that time. The ruling from the Supreme Court made it pretty clear that, it's the reason that Wake County is really the only county in the last 10 years that's redrawn their superior court districts, and that's because of the way that they were set up, and it was very similar. It was very similar to the map I presented earlier in Mecklenburg County, where you had one district that had 400 in Mecklenburg County, one district that has 450,000 residents in it, electing two judges, and you have another district that has 150,000 residents in it, also electing two judges within one judicial district. And that is simply not fair to the voters in that judicial district. We need to make sure that those election districts are split up fairly within each individual judicial district. But population plays no role in how districts are divided, the actual judicial districts are divided up across the state. Population may play a factor in terms of how we need to invest additional resources in a particular judicial district moving forward, but not in how they're set up.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized, Senator.
And the question is this, sir. I'm very familiar with Blankenship, and I've read it and understand it, and I understand what was in dicta. I understand what was in the holding, and it was clearly looking at a sub-district within a county, you know, a larger district. But it seems that the question which you are raising begs to look at a perhaps more holistic solution. And when I say that, if we were to look at the population of this state and then divide in the number of district court judges that we have and the number of superior court judges that we have, it may give you a potential ratio of the number of judges you would then perhaps need in this state and how they might be apportioned, and it might give you some sort of a map for placing and deploying our judicial resources that would look different than what the map does today that you've presented us with. So I understand Blankenship. I understand what it says about congressional districts being the same size, one man, one vote. I understand legislative districts have to be within 5% plus or minus of an optimal size. But if we are looking at this holistically, would you have any objections to us looking at the entire state? And if there are so-called inequities of population and deployment of our judicial resources, trying to address that holistically as opposed to just in one or two counties?
I certainly invite you to bring forth any proposals you have. on this topic and trying to make sure that we're providing the resources needed in the judicial branch.
Secure.
One further follow-up, sure. Senator McKissick.
If you could articulate, what were the actual criteria and standards that were used, if you could, in drawing up the map that was a part of your bill? I mean, if I always find it's good to establish a set of criteria, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, whatever they may be, and then apply those uniformly in trying to come up with a solution as opposed to doing it on an ad hoc or anecdotal basis. So was there a set of criteria that were used, and if there were, could you share those with us?
Senator McKissick attempted to use similar requirements to what are in place for legislative and congressional maps with respect to staying within that 5% deviation, making sure that the districts are as close to being balanced as possible with respect to the number of judges that they have in them. So looking at those, taking that into account, at first or did not look at where incumbents lived at with respect to the election districts. That was only taken into account or factored in later editions as a travel to state meeting with judicial leaders, and they had a request here or there, so we tried to accommodate those where it was possible to do so. So, for example, in Guilford County, where there were some requests from some of their judicial leaders and judges, Buncombe County, where there was a request, so taking those into account after the fact. So it's we've worked to accommodate any of those that have come from any of the counties that we travel to or have heard from where they're reasonable and there's a legitimate reason to make a change.
Speaker Jackson is recognized.
I really appreciate this promotion I've received. Representative Burr, you referenced the unfairness. I think unfairness was the word you used, or unfair, about Mecklenburg County and the number of people in one district compared to the other one. But under the plan that you've presented, a voter in Durham County only gets to vote for two out of their seven district court judges, but a voter in Gaston County gets to vote for all seven of their district court judges. Do you think that's fair?
Representative Jackson, we took the existing policy that has been in place in North Carolina with respect to the urban counties, and for a long time it has been the practice that we have election districts, the sub-districts in our larger urban counties. We incorporated, updated, and incorporated that in where they may not have been in the our eight largest counties, the eight largest judicial districts there, which pulled Buncombe County into that mix. But have not gone below that in terms of adding any other counties in, simply trying to update those that were already sort of in that mix for Superior Court, and then also adding the District Court in. There were a handful of counties that had District Court sub-districts and worked to make sure that we were sort of being fair across the board or equal in how we did that, and tried to make sure that for an election district in a large urban area that it was for Superior and for District. It made no sense to me that there were these large urban counties where you had a Superior Court judge serving an eight-year term who was running in a small district, and you had a District Court judge who was running for a four-year term running countywide. It sort of seemed a little backwards to me, or at least that they should be on the same playing field there. So brought them all into those election districts. Now, the reason, and you bring up Durham, if I'm not mistaken, you were in the committee. I believe we added another judge back to Durham at the request of the delegation there, even though the workload data shows that they didn't need it. So through an amendment that was proposed, it added we added back in one additional district court judge. So it'd give us more time to hopefully get some clear-cut evidence that you actually need that seventh district court judge in Durham County.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Representative Byrd, do you think it's fair that voters in Durham only get to elect two out of their seven district court judges, and voters in Gaston County can elect all seven of their district court judges? I didn't get the answer to the first one, right?
Objection asked and answered. Representative Burr, you don't have to answer that if you want to, but if you want to go further at it, he thinks he'd like to ask you again.
The question was, is that fair?
Yes, sir. I believe that it is, because it's been the policy in the state that we have election districts in the judicial districts across our state in the urban counties. And we're just continuing a policy that's been in place for, 30 years for Superior Court, 25 years or so for district court, and I don't recall any judge or any legislator introducing any bill to eliminate any of those in the last 20 or 30 years, certainly not in the last 10 years I've been here.
Chair will note, anybody could make such a proposal, and Representative Hall is recognized.
But I had a follow-up.
Oh, I beg your pardon. You'll be recognized for further follow-up, Representative Jackson.
Thank you. And are any of our current district court districts unconstitutional?
Yes. Representative Burr, you're recognized.
I believe so.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
You may
follow up. And you can answer it too, Mr. Chairman, if you like. I mean, are there any pending lawsuits questioning the constitutionality of any of the pending of the current district court judgeships in the state of North Carolina?
There are none that I know of, but Representative Jackson, I think our duty here is to correct an injustice when we see one. Certainly, you look at the Mecklenburg County election subdistricts that they have for their Superior Court districts, and you can't tell me that that's fair, that 50% over 50% of Mecklenburg County's population only gets to elect two of their seven Superior Court judges.
The chair would note, Representative Hall, that whether something's constitutional or not doesn't depend on whether a lawsuit's been filed. Representative Hall, you're recognized.
Do I get a follow-up, Mr.
I'll come back to you, Representative Jackson. We'll get some other folks to ask questions. Representative Hall, Representative Johns. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
The Speaker began his presentation by offering quite a few numbers, a litany of different numbers. I'd like to just offer one number to this committee, and the reason I'm offering this number is I think it gets to the heart, the crux, or at least one of the main reasons we've seen opposition to these new districts. And that number is a percentage, and it's 60. Under these plans, 60% of all African-American judges have been double-bunked. And I hope that's a number we'll consider and keep in mind as this committee goes forward.
Did you have a question?
A separate question, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized for a question.
In response to Senator McKissick's question on the criteria used, your response was the same that was used for the legislative and congressional maps. Are you aware that both of those sets of maps have been declared unconstitutional?
You're recognized to answer the question if you choose to, Representative
Thank
Burr.
You.
Seemed like it might be rhetorical.
Yeah, I think it was. I read the newspaper and very well aware of what's going on. Representative Hall, if I could pose a question to Representative Hall, if he'll yield to one. You mentioned specific individuals that you claim are double bunked, and you quoted a stat. Can you provide me a list of all the judges that you claim are double bunked since you've apparently put this together? Do you have that to submit to this committee today? And can you give me the names of all the judges you claim are double bunked? And further, can you tell me, did you develop this list, or who did?
Representative Hall, you're recognized.
I'm not sure which one to answer first, but yes, we'll be happy to get you a list. And I believe since you actually drew the districts, I would assume that you're aware of what number of African-American judges have been double-bunked. Is it your contention that more than half of them have not been double-bunked?
Representative Burr.
Representative Hall, as I said earlier, I did not take into account the residents of the existing judges unless there was an issue that was raised as we traveled across the state, worked to accommodate them where there were issues. But did if you could answer, I know I asked you two or three questions there, but can you tell me where
we'll be happy
you
to bring back
this?
The list, and at the next meeting we could submit that to the committee. I greatly appreciate it.
Do you
glad to have it
follow up?
Representative Burr, you're recognized.
Can you tell me, you quoted a stat there, can you tell me, just read off the names of the judges that are double bunked? Do you have that, or are you just quoting a stat from the newspaper?
Representative Hall.
I'm quoting a statistical fact, but no, I don't have a list in front of me.
Okay.
Senator Hyes, did you, for what purpose do you seek to be recognized?
I just wanted to reiterate, as we've had someone who said they would submit what could in effect be judges' residency and others, that is protected information, and any time we say we'll accept that as a committee or other, we need to be very careful that we are not putting out where judges live into public domain.
Thanks for the admonition. Senator Hyes will take it under advisement how to handle the data if it's remitted to the committee chairs. Representative Jordan, you sought recognition. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Burr, for the presentation. I wanted to just ask if you could do a little further discussion on the issue of the residency districts that were mentioned. We have some already existing. We have some that were in the House plan, but there are none in the Senate plan. And just, is that correct?
That's correct. Representative Jordan, the Senate proposed in their plan to do away with residency districts because there was an issue raised by a couple of individuals that made presentations to their select committee. Raising a constitutional concern about residency districts, but there seem to be a number of differing opinions on whether that's a true concern or not.
So follow up.
You're recognized.
So, but that is still something that will be discussed going forward.
Certainly.
Potentially.
Okay, Senator Chaudhary, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Burr, for being with us again this afternoon. So you've also shared with us the numbers, five committee meetings, 24 hours spent, 25 hours spent, six proposals and versions. Can you tell us the number of stakeholder organizations that have endorsed your redistricting plan?
Senator, haven't asked or solicited for any to endorse the proposal.
Certainly, based on your last presentation to the Senate Select Committee, you had said that there were no stakeholder organizations that had supported this redistricting plan, correct?
As far as I know, there aren't any. I believe their objection seems to be the fact that the legislature is doing its constitutional duties and meeting those obligations that we have to update these districts and make investments where necessary and where needed to support the judicial branch, and we're doing that and meeting our obligation there. Perhaps they're unhappy that we're not just turning over the legislature's role to an unelected group of individuals to draw these maps. But it's at the end of the day, it's our responsibility, and that's why I brought the plan forward.
Follow up.
You're recognized.
Could you tell us a little bit about how the maps are drawn? Did you draw the maps? Did Speaker Moore's staff draw the maps? How were the maps drawn?
The maps were drawn. I've worked with, for the House plan, worked with central staff to draft plans that balanced out the election sub-districts. And certainly it takes time as they work through and plug those in, and we try to make sure that the population in each district balances out. So we work together, myself and central staff.
What?
You're recognized for a follow-up.
So did you direct central staff when you were applying the criterion standards that you set out, that you shared with the committee?
Yes, sir, we worked, and at the end of the day, the decisions on the maps came back to me, and wanted to make sure and always looked at the deviations to make sure that we had that within the 5%, and I try to make sure that we respected the power of the vote and the balance of the number of judges to the residents that were in each of the districts that we proposed.
Representative John is recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a series of questions if I might be permitted to
if you'll
ask those.
Just come through the chair.
All right,
probably
thank you, sir. First of all, Representative Burr, before I get into my list, you said you'd since introducing your bill, you've contacted or been in discussion with 120 judges. Prior to the time or as of the date your bill was introduced in, I believe it was House Judiciary Committee 1 back in June, how many judges had you discussed your proposed districting with?
Very few.
Truthfully, zero. Is that correct?
No.
Well, by very few, could you give an approximate number, please?
The gentleman's recognized for a question.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I don't have it, but happy to do some figuring later on and get you a number, but as a limited number. And as I think I've mentioned in the past, certainly when we started out this process and went down the road of working towards judicial redistricting, there were many individuals that were opposed to doing anything, and they're perfectly fine with the status quo of keeping the existing districts in place, even though many of them are unfair to the constituents that they serve and the fact that the districts aren't balanced out. Certainly, we've worked over 7 months to lay out a case to why something needs to be done, and I think even those that might even not necessarily like proposals that I brought forward are now have gone from saying absolutely do nothing to something should be happen. Something should happen. I'm just waiting on those that say something should happen to actually present a plan other than they don't like this one.
All right. Senator McKissick asked you what
Representative John, you seek to ask another question?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
I'll try to be careful about seeking your approval. Thank you.
You have the floor.
Thank you. Senator McKissick asked you what criteria you considered in drawing your maps, and you responded the 5% population deviation similar to that used in legislative redistricting. What other criteria, if any, did you utilize?
In terms of drawing the maps, the 5%?
Yes, sir.
The 5% deviation.
That was the only criteria?
My intention was to make sure that the districts were balanced out and fair for the voters in those counties.
So to be clear, may I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So to be clear, you did not consider then the racial composition of the population in the proposed districts, your proposed district?
No, sir.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
You're recognized.
Thank you. You did not consider the race of incumbent judges in your proposed districts?
No, sir.
Did you follow up, Mr. Chair?
A number of members waiting to be recognized, but you're recognized for another question.
I have
question,
two or three,
John.
If I could, please. Thank you, sir. You did not consider the results of any elections in the areas of your proposed districts?
The results of elections was included in the packets, and I know as we went through and had discussions in a number of counties, I believe that those issues were really raised after the fact. I know Representative Harrison brought me a proposal and believe the plan that she presented, it presented in a way that it was stated that it was three Democrat districts and two Republicans. So, you know, that was looked at by members, I guess, as they developed amendments and prepared plans. And I certainly can't say that it wasn't part of the discussion as it seemed to be on both sides of the aisle.
All right. I believe that's all, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Reeves is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to get back to an earlier set of questions, and so I want to make sure I was clear. Some of them have already been asked, and I don't know if I need to ask this of staff. Are these districts subject at all to the Voting Rights Act?
Representative Reeves, as far as I know, we've worked to stay within the bounds of the law to update these districts, and if there's any concerns or any issues that need to be brought forward, I welcome you to do it. But no one has brought any concerns forward to me concerning those matters at this time.
Follow up, please.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Okay, and I'm asking, it may be a better question for staff, because I'm asking because I don't know.
Yeah.
But based on the questions I've heard, it would seem that if they're subject to the Voting Rights Act, then we might need to change the approach that we've done on a couple of things. So may I ask that question of staff, Mr. Chair?
I'll ask staff if they're prepared to respond to that. Mr. Churchill?
Representative Reeves, we know that, yes, the Voting Rights Act does apply. Section 2 is still in place and still applicable throughout the country. What we don't know, simply because judges are not an elected representative, is exactly how Section 2 applies to the judicial districts. We do know here in North Carolina there was something of a Section 2 claim brought back in the 80s that resulted in some of the sub-county districts that have come to exist. We know that there was a consent order entered into with the Department of Justice from that. How that continues to apply, we're not sure, because it was a consent order that never went to trial.
You'd seek to be recognized for another question, Mr. Reeves?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Well, then, based on that, then we have to take race into account in some form or fashion. Isn't that correct? Now, this is also for staff.
Mr. Churchill?
As staff, we're not sure. We know that it applies, but we don't know exactly how it applies. So exactly how you would take that into account, we can't answer.
Then I have two follow-ups based on that, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Okay. Then was it ever brought to the attention of anyone on the committee, Representative Burr, that there was possibly going to be double bunking of African-American judges? Did anybody ever hear about that?
Mr. Chair.
You're recognized to respond. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you going to respond, Representative Burr? You want to hear?
I will, but I believe.
I'm sorry, Representative Daniel, or Senator Daniel, for what purpose?
I'm just wondering. I mean, this is a bill that passed the House. I assume they had extensive debate about these particular questions, and they were asked and answered then. Are we just going to rehash?
The chair would note that the purpose of this joint select committee is to have an open and free-flowing discussion about possibilities, and so it is a good observation that this legislation has already emerged from the House that Representative Burr is speaking to. But if you want to raise that in the context of comparing the two, the demonstration maps that were released by the Senate Select Committee or something else, Senator Daniels' point's well taken. Nonetheless, Representative Reeves, I'll ask you if you want to state another question, please do so.
Yes, and I just, for clarity's sake, I unfortunately wasn't on that committee, and didn't get a chance to hear anybody asking that. And so I apologize if I'm repeating things that were brought up in the initial committee, but I just wanted to know since we're voting. But then the other question I would have is, if I'm hearing correctly, then if it does turn out that as many as 60% of African-American judges have been double bunked, then are we as a committee going to address that and make sure that that doesn't happen? Is that what I'm hearing?
Perhaps that question is to the chair, and I would answer you this way, Representative Reeves. At this point, all I know is there's been a question as to whether or not that's the case. No data has been submitted. No members asked staff, to my knowledge, to provide that information. There was an inquiry about the locations of judges and how that whether there'd be any double bunking issues. The last meeting of the Senate Select Committee, which Senator McKissick sought information, I know that as of the beginning of this meeting, there was a conversation in the hall about the AOC. Judges' address information is protected, and so Senator McKissick is in consultation with the AOC, proceeding with some care to figure out how to move forward to obtain the data he's asked for without compromising that confidential information. Is that a fair summary, Senator McKissick?
That would be accurate. I mean, I think we're probably doing it by voter tabulation district as opposed to address, and that way the data will be definitive. Of course, this related to both the House plan as well as the Senate plan, so it would apply to both.
Representative Burr, did you want to add something there?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Reeves, when issues were brought up concerning judges that might be a double bunked or want to be in a different district than what they were in the original proposed maps, we worked to accommodate those across the state. For example, there was originally some judges, Superior Court judges, that were double bunked that we could address in the Forsyth County maps, in the House maps for Forsyth County, work to address that. We worked to accommodate concerns in Mecklenburg County by actually sort of reworking the overall districts that we had proposed to accommodate concerns raised by the judges there, or not necessarily some concerns, but a number of suggestions that were raised of how to do it to prevent any issues with double bunking of some of their judges. So we worked to try to accommodate those concerns where it was possible. Certainly, if you don't bring the issues, if you don't bring a specific issue forward, and you're just talking, you know, generally about some potential double bunking, you can't fix something if you don't provide us with information. And that's why I asked earlier to Representative Hall if he has a list and if there's concerns. I've certainly not had no judges have contacted me to say that they would like for us to try to rework a certain district because of concerns with double bunking of groups of judges or so forth. I think some of the confusion, quite frankly, Representative Reeves, comes from the fact that we proposed multi-member districts in a lot of these urban counties rather than the single-member districts, for example, that you have in Wake County. We proposed multi-member districts because in the House we heard this concern about that, well, there aren't enough attorneys that may live in these individual districts, so you need a bigger pool of potential applicants that could run for them. So creating multi-member districts, we try to do that to accommodate that concern, but it comes back to the fact that you may have one district, but it may have two or three or four judges that are elected within it, and are you counting those in there even though there's multiple judges that may be sitting in one district, but you're leaving out the fact that there are multiple seats for them to run for? And is that factored into the numbers that you're throwing out and that Representative Hall are throwing out? And that's where it would be helpful if you'd actually provide some data that we could look at.
Representative Reeves, you want to follow up?
Yes, and I think this would be more of a statement. I just want to be clear about something. I'm not throwing anything out. I'm asking a question as to whether or not it's there. And I'm just, I'm shocked that nobody's brought it up to the committee at an earlier time, because I got calls on this every day that we were double bunking African-American judges left and right. I don't know what that number is. I was hoping we had that number. So what I would ask, Mr. Chair, then, since nobody seems to have brought this up until today, that we get staff to give us a listing of who's been double bunked and the percentages of those compared to other judges that are being double bunked. Are we just double bunking African-American judges? Are we double bunking everybody? What's happening? So we can have a comparison, because I think that you should pay attention and come and see when you're changing districts for the first time in 50 years. But I want to be clear. I'm not trying to put any numbers out, because I don't know. That's why I'm asking the question. And so I understand if you're saying that Representative Hall is throwing out a number, but I want to be clear. I'm not trying to throw anything out. I'm asking a question. If we've got answers, I just want somebody to answer.
Now, Representative Reeves, I guess what I would say to that, and maybe, you know, we're obviously transitioned from the Senate Select Committee to now this Joint Select Committee. I'm hoping there'll be sort of a continuity in those two processes. Senator McKissick has made a similar request of staff for that data. I'm not sure if it's as comprehensive as what you have in mind. I didn't understand part of what you said. But I wonder if the two of you might work together to consolidate your what you're interested in and make the request of staff, and if you're inclined to do so, have staff furnish the information to the committee so that we can share it with the members.
And Mr. Kerr, I think that request has, and I know I have made that request.
Right,
so
subject to
the
complication, Senator McKissick, we were talking about earlier, right?
That's exactly correct, Mr. Kerr, that we spoke of earlier today before the meeting. And so the request has been made. It was made in connection with the Senate plan, but as well as the House plan. We believe that the data is basically available. We're just trying to do it in a way that does not present challenges relating to policies dealing with disclosure of addresses of judges. So, I mean, that's the only thing that I think would be the issue, and I spoke with Judge Warren of AOC about this as recently as today. So I think the request has been made and is in the process. And staff is already working on this as well as about a half dozen other requests, which I've made and probably met with them for 2 hours about recently as yesterday.
So, Representative Reeves, is that satisfactory to you?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Very good. Then Senator Van Dyne, I've seen your hand. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to say that my folks in Eka Kamler or Lester or Sandy Mush or Barnardsville might question being categorized as an urban county, but given that as it may, what characteristics of an urban county, given that it has a similar population of a rural county, makes it incompetent to elect multiple judges, and in fact maybe all of the judges that those folks might have to appear in front of?
Representative
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevens.
A point of order. I believe that we are still, thank you, I believe that we are still covered under our rules of order for the facility, and it appears she's making a lot of derogatory assumptions and trying to put them into Mr. Representative Burr's mouth. So I would ask that we be cautioned and we strike that.
I'll allow it. I will say to all the members that I'll say two things. One is that the purpose of a very elongated process to deliberate over this important matter is to attempt to elicit ideas, proposals to solve a serious problem. Now, I understand there may be folks who believe there is no problem in the maps in Mecklenburg County that we saw, notwithstanding what the Supreme Court said in Blankenship. And if that's, and you're certainly entitled to that view. But if the questions seem to be uniformly argumentative almost, and so, you know, that certainly may not be productive in terms of trying to move us toward the solution to the problem that we need to solve. But certainly the main point is to ask factual questions at this stage, and we've got a segment of the agenda for discussion and other business. If others want to offer comments, given the time that's permitted or that's remaining, Representative Stevens, you need to follow up.
If I may, just for clarification, my biggest objection to what she stated was there's an assumption that Representative Burr thinks her voters in the rural area are incompetent.
I think if I were a judge, I'd rule it out of order. But I think what I would offer is if Representative Burr wishes to respond to the question, I'll recognize him.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
Senator, Buncombe County is going to have an opportunity, no matter where you live, to elect multiple judges. There are multiple district court judges that are in each of the proposed districts that are being brought forth with the House map and the Senate map. So that is they're going to have that opportunity, but just like any other urban county, and I understand you may have parts of a county that don't feel like they're an urban county, but certainly the same could be said for Durham County. I think that the argument could be made there are parts of Durham that would say they're not very urban and very much rural, but they've had sub-districts for 30 years as well. So, as I said earlier, I don't recall any legislator, any judge proposing to do away with the election sub-districts. And what we've tried to do is to make sure that for the largest counties in North Carolina that we're being consistent in how we treat them. And those eight largest counties, we have election sub-districts in those counties, and Buncombe falls in that mix.
Thank you.
Do you seek to follow up?
Please.
You're recognized.
I think I've been pretty clear on this, so I won't belabor it. Thank you. I still think the definition of urban versus rural is kind of lame, but I will let that go. I think there are two issues that we're trying to address here. One is how we elect our judges, and the other is, do we have the right number of judges in the right place. I think that second issue might be even more important. And my understanding is that we are basing our workload analysis based on the number of filings. And I think that this is an area that I would really like to understand better because I do know, and this has to do with my position on the Buncombe County Health Board of Health and Human Services, I do know that we have a really critical bottleneck with respect to being able to meet the federal guidelines of placing children in permanent situations within 30 days, and the lack of courtroom time is a problem for us. So what I'm asking is, as we deliberate this whole issue, could we, I think we really need a presentation on how we evaluate our workload and are we getting enough information? I understand there are a lot of ways to look at this, and I just don't think we're doing an adequate job of making sure we've got enough judges where there is a critical need to serve the needs of our families.
Senator Van Dyne, as I mentioned to Senator Blue earlier, there was the presentation that Administrative Office of the Courts gave the Senate Select Committee. I don't know if you're present for that. Are you asking the chair, and the chairs would have to consult, of course, but are you asking for a repeat of the AOC presentation?
Well, and I apologize. I did have a dental emergency, and I missed one meeting. But I just really think number of filings is just an insufficient way to look at this problem, particularly in light of the opioid crisis that we're having and some of the issues that Senator Blue mentioned earlier about the complexity of issues not being a factor.
Thank you, Senator Van Dyne. Representative Byrd, are you recognized?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I certainly hear what you're saying, and that's one of the reasons that during, in particular, the months of July and August, I traveled around the state to go to many of the judicial districts, including yours, and I traveled up to Buncombe County and met with most of your judges and judicial leaders in Buncombe County. And tried to accommodate requests, and I'll go back and look at my notes. I don't believe they ever requested any more judges or any type of staff like that. So certainly had they made that request, I would have taken it into consideration, but that request wasn't made, and I was sitting in a room with the people that really should have been the ones making that request and making the argument. So, you know, if you've got some data or something we need to look at, certainly happy to do it. And
I'm happy to submit that data.
Representative Jackson, did you seek to ask another question?
I had a question of Ms. Churchill about the consent decree, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized to ask your question, Ms. Churchill.
Ms. Churchill, that consent decree that was talked about from the 80s, was the state of North Carolina a party of that?
If you'll give me a minute, I'll find a copy and let you know.
You can come back to me, Mr. Chairman.
Very well. Senator Burr, recognized. I'm sorry, Senator Blue. Excuse me. Thank you. Sorry, Senator.
We all look alike.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Just again, going back to just what's intuitive, Representative Burr, the workload data is something that I've reflected on, and I know there was a slight presentation of it. Is it your understanding that the workload data that AOC has was compiled in 2006 or sometime thereabouts? It's my understanding that that data was 11 or 12 years old. And if you're basing 2018 decisions on data that that came before the latest census, In fact, almost right through the middle of the census cycle, to determine what's fair in various counties, it seems an odd way to do it. But more importantly,
More importantly, since you say these districts haven't been changed in 30-plus years, wouldn't it make sense, number one, to have reliable data? That is, give AOC the $160,000, $170,000 that it costs to get reliable current workforce data, workload data. But secondly, wait for 2 years when the 2020 census is done so that you won't have to repeat the same exercise 2 years, 3 years from now after the 2021 data, because you're going to have these districts as far out of proportion in 2021 as you claim Mecklenburg County is now. From the time this last workload data was done, study was done, Wake County has probably added over 300,000 people, and I wouldn't be surprised if a similar number of people had been added in Mecklenburg, in addition to the 400,000 that you got in the district that you're recreating. So I'm simply asking, even if there is a need to readjust these, shouldn't it be done with reliable data and with current census data rather than something that was done a decade ago?
Senator Blue, before I recognize Representative Byrd to respond to your question, let me offer one thing. This is another area that's been sufficiently interesting to me as we've embarked on this to try to learn about it myself. So I have gotten the time study and the full study that was done to develop the workload formulas by AOC. That was done the one I've seen for district attorneys was done in 2010, for example. But they update the numbers that flow through those methodology they follow a methodology by the National Center for State Courts, I think, as they explained to us in our earlier meeting, and they update those regularly. So the latest data that I saw for the judges and the district attorneys and so forth was dated July of 2017. So that's pretty current data. But subject to that, I recognize Representative Byrd to respond to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, to your question about waiting until after the 2020 census, Senator Blue, I think we've kicked this can down the road far enough, and these districts should be updated today. We should not go through two more election cycles. That's what you're talking about, going through two more election cycles without making these changes and making sure that the districts are balanced. And that wouldn't be fair to the voters and the constituents served in those counties. And with respect to your question about the workload data, and I think the chair just touched on it, I believe the framework was originally developed back in the early 2000s. But it is updated every year. So I don't think you're correct about the data being that old.
Senator McKissick, did you seek recognition? I'm sorry, Senator Blue, are you finished with that point?
I know I'm correct, I'm finished.
Senator McKissick, you're recognized.
Sure. Representative Burr, have you had a chance to discuss with the Administrative Office of the Court in connection with the workload data, the extent to which they take into account the disposition rates of cases, the continuance policies as it relates to continuance of different types of cases in both Superior Court and District Court in different jurisdictions, as well as policies of prosecutors that they might have in terms of the types of cases that they actually try? Because all of this workload data is based upon a set of parameters that, from what I gather, has not taken those very, very significant factors into consideration, and that's based upon meeting with AOC and Mr. Fowler.
You're recognized to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I didn't get into a debate with AOC about their workload formula. We use their workload formula, and if there was a particular judicial district that had an issue or concern with what the data showed, was more than happy to meet with them and try to address those concerns, but did not go down the road of trying to debate them on that information. They put it together. I certainly trust that information coming from the judicial branch, and would assume if there were some issue with it that the judges and the leaders in the judicial branch would work that out and make sure that it's correct, and we have to rely on what we receive.
Very quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
What I would suggest that you do is, since the population data is one of the parameters which you've identified, and we know that we're looking at 2010 data, not 2016 or I think that's the latest data, but it's not census data. It's certainly not going to be current as what it is today with our state now the nice most populous state. And since we're depending upon the AOC workload data, if you could go back to AOC and perhaps we can bring them in to discuss. These were concerns raised by Judge Buckner in particular when he spoke before the Senate committee dealing with these issues about the disposition rates of cases, about the continuance policies, about prosecutorial policies in terms of disposition of cases and types of cases they try, and even issues relating to the availability of resources to collect data for crimes so that you can actually prosecute cases effectively in a timely way. I think those are all critical in terms of identifying the number of judges, particularly in our urban areas where there's far more higher incidences of crime. We need to really drill down into that data and try to make sure that it's as accurate as possible. And I'm sure they've collected it, but I know that there's some omissions and some in voids in terms of what they have. And if you perhaps could work with them to identify those voids and to take those into account as we move forward, it would be appreciated, sir.
Chair recognizes Senator Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in listening to Senator Blue, I guess my recollection of what the AOC said, Judge Warren, when he came, is somewhat different. And I'm concerned because I thought that basically the AOC has current data in order to assign judges where they're assigned. So we rely on that data to assign judges currently. And so I'm concerned that if there's a difference in view as to whether or not this data is current, or as Senator Blue said, whether it's reliable, and whether or not we need to spend another $160,000. I'm not sure where that number came from, but basically a number of questions that are sort of different than when the Senate Select Panel met and heard from the AOC.
Senator Barrett, I guess I'd say in response to that we certainly, chairs, can consult with each other about whether repeating that presentation for remedial purposes would be helpful, but so we'll undertake that under advisement.
One follow-up, just a clarification from AOC, if nothing else.
Thanks, Senator. Let's see. I think Representative John I had on my list. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Byrd, just to be clear, when I asked you what criteria you considered, I did not hear AOC workload formula in your response. Did you or did you not consider AOC workload formula in drawing your proposed districts?
If you're talking about the overall judicial districts, absolutely. My understanding from your question was you're talking about the election sub-districts. So determining how many judges are within each district, you would look at AOC's workload analysis, right, and the need there. And then within each of those districts, you would divide up the number in urban counties, you would divide up the number of judges based on what they had for those sub-districts, and you would take into account the population, that 5% deviation.
The chair would advise the members that all of that data is broken down by district is on the Senate Select Committee's website for the first meeting where the House plans were reviewed. Representative John, are you done?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Any other members seeking recognition? Senator Randleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have sat and I have listened to people talking about the workload formulas. And as the appropriation chair on the Senate side, you know, we look at the data on an annual basis, so we get a report from the AOC every year that shows us what the workload, we get a workload formula. And this workload formula, not only do they take in filings, they also show dispositions and they show them at the different levels. And this allows us to determine how many judges are needed. This is what we rely on. It is reliable. From my perspective, these numbers are reliable. They're compiled by the AOC, and they are used to determine staffing based on filings and dispositions.
Thank you, Senator. Other senators seeking to be recognized for a question? Representative, I'm sorry, our members. Representative Jackson.
I was following up with Ms. Churchill, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Churchill, are you prepared to give an answer?
Yes, we have located a copy of the consent decree filed on November 25th, 1987. It is Kelly Alexander Jr. et al., plaintiff, versus James G. Martin et al., defendants. Don't have my hands on any of the background documents to know what the additional defendants and plaintiffs were, but we can look into that.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you. Follow-up. Ms. Churchill, if if that consent decree, if the General Assembly or the State of North Carolina was in fact a party to that lawsuit, and I know you don't know that yet, but if they were, do we have the power to change these maps without first going into federal court and asking that consent decree be terminated?
I think that would take a little bit further study, but it is very clear that since 1987, the General Assembly has made changes to the maps already.
All right. Any members seeking recognition for questions? We have, we'll move then to the final order of business, which is discussion or other business. And if other members have comments, I noticed that in the course of the questions, I don't think there have been any about the differences between the Senate and the House maps. The Senate, of course, are just maps that have been released as demonstration maps by the chairs of the Senate Select Committee. But in any event, I'll leave the floor open for a bit of discussion. And Senator and Representative Blust, I saw Senator Choudhury's hand first. So, Senator Choudhury, I recognize you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question with regard to process, and this is somewhat of a follow-up. Senator McKissick is not here. So the Senate Select Committee that concluded its business last week, I guess, was tantamount to almost couples therapy in my mind, because we had the opportunity to talk about the opportunity to really restart, and this is being kind of a refreshment of the discussion of how we tackle judicial reform and redistricting. And so my question to you, as someone who is steering the ship that we are all on this journey on, is when do we get to our destination? I guess my question is that we have heard from Representative Burr, I've heard in a few instances from you that there is the perspective that there's an urgency to address the maps. There's certainly another set of viewpoints that come from other members of this committee that believe that we need to go slow in how we address this issue. And so my question is, how long will this committee be in session, or how many meetings do you expect us to have before we come to any resolution on this issue?
I'm not in a position to answer that question, Senator Choudhury. Among other reasons, I haven't consulted with co-chairs about what that answer would be, and I don't know if any co-chair – I'd be surprised if any co-chair has an answer to that question either. What we have undertaken to do, and what I think is important to do, is afford every opportunity for any member to bring forward ideas that best deal with the many trade-offs that we face – in any course of action to deal with the problem. The one course of action that I believe, and as you said it in your question, that I believe is not at all allowable, is to do nothing in the face of at least one county's obvious noncompliance with the Blankenship decision. And so where you go from there are many trade-offs. And so, to speak to Senator Newton's presentation earlier today, we've been spending the last hour roughly on election district questions. You could go an entirely different direction. And so if members are interested in doing that, these processes have been intended to see those ideas emerge. And I think we want to go as long as possible to where it seems like it's possible that other ideas may emerge. And if it becomes clear that they won't, then presumably we'll bring it to a close. But I would say the worst thing that we could do would be to shorten it too much. But the tone of this meeting has been different than what you described as couples therapy in the Senate, perhaps. So we'll see how constructive they continue to be. You're recognized to follow up, Senator.
Just one follow up from a practical perspective. Obviously, I would encourage the co-chairs to at least establish meeting dates going forward for the next three or four meetings, given the fact that we are a part-time legislature, and it would help those of us that have employment, such as you and the other co-chairs, to try to make sure that we mark this time for our calendars going forward.
I will take that under advisement, Senator Choudhury, and share it. Some of us actually have employment in other counties, so it's it is a burdensome obligation that we're all undertaking right now, but a very important one. Other members seeking recognition, say, that's right, Representative Jackson, I believe you wanted to. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'd seen Representative Blust and forgot to call back on him. Representative Blust, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to try to figure out where we are in regard to the maps, if we're back on the House, because I know the Senate had a committee and they came up with different maps than was in the House bill. And I've just heard, I don't know if it's accurate or not, that we're now giving that up and we're going back to the bill that passed the House. And I'm interested in that because I think for Guilford, the House map had been worked out. And not that everyone supported the bill, but I think the delegation supported what we had done for Guilford as opposed to some other plan for Guilford. So could the chair shed some light on where we are?
I think I can say, Representative Blust, where we are procedurally. So House Bill 717 passed the House. I don't remember when exactly. But it is in the Senate Rules Committee. Senate Select Committee didn't have jurisdiction over any legislation. What we did was undertook to do was look carefully at the districting plan to solicit other ideas for judicial selection, to explore other models in the country, as you heard Senator Newton talk about, and proceed to develop ideas. One of those ideas are maps, and the Senate maps, as they've been referred to today, are probably shouldn't be called that exactly. For shorthand, that's fine, but they are only demonstration maps that were released by the chairs. The staff prepared them. They were primarily the instruction was to eliminate what we had been advised by some presenters who appeared before the committee said were constitutional deficiencies. That is to say, the imbalances in Mecklenburg and what that might imply for other counties around the state that have fairly substantial imbalances. And we just approached it on a 5% plus or minus population where you had similarly situated districts. And then the other one was we'd been advised by one presenter, his opinion, that there may be a constitutional deficiency to having these residency districts. That's a closer call from what I understand. But those maps were released for discussion. That's all that has occurred. Next, for that legislation to advance one way or the other, it would have to move from Senate Rules Committee, presumably to a committee of jurisdiction, and then be acted on, and then be acted on by the Senate in whatever form, and then, you know, further action from there. Representative Blust, follow up?
More concerns than questions, and they're somewhat related. I'm not sure how tied up a potential move to a merit selection is to the new districts, but just wanted to express a concern with merit selection, which I think, just like independent redistricting, I supported at some sort of idealistic notion somewhere off, but the hard detail is actually determining what merit is and who gets to decide what merit is, because on judicial issues, on justice, I saw people yesterday carrying signs that they want justice. Some people think justice means one thing, and somebody else thinks justice means another. Some people think merit, what makes a good judge, is one thing. Some people think something totally different. So the hard part is in the details of who gets to determine the merit and how do you work that out? But the practical problem I think I have with it, I think if we came up with a foolproof system, I don't think, honestly, the public's going to accept it. And people in here are probably like I am. Around election time, I get a lot of calls from voters, who should I vote for these judges? I'm convinced 90% don't know who the judges are. They go in and vote two names. That's one reason we made them put the partisan affiliation with them, because that's the one thing people can understand, and it's important to a lot of people. But I'm very worried that the public, although they don't know who they're voting for, if you tried to take away that vote, I think that's going to be very unpopular. And I'm thinking it's not going to go anywhere no matter what we do. Mixed up in that is something else I'd like to do as a committee. I don't know what the timing is, but I do really think, and I think it had something to do with the districting, I really think we need to restore the primaries. Knowing the calls I get already when there's two names on a ballot for each position, I can just imagine what the public is going to do when they see 10 names possibly, and it could happen in Guilford, 10 names or 15 for a district court judge, and people, who do I vote for, all these names? I think that's going to be a mess, and it's not going to reflect well on us if we don't allow it to be pared, the number of people who file to be pared down in a primary. And I also think there'll be a lot more candidates thinking, hey, I might win with 15% of the vote. I'm going to go ahead and file and see where it goes, because there's a lot of people, and I don't know as much in a rural county, but in urban county, I think almost every assistant public defender and every assistant DA dreams of being a judge. And I think you'll just see a boatload of names in the November ballot is going to be very long at the end, with a ton of names for people running for judges, and not to mention appellate, because we saw a few years ago, I think didn't we have 19 names trying to fill a vacancy when the timing didn't permit a primary. So I'd like to, whatever we do, I would like to add back the primary for judge races.
Thank you, Representative Lust. Others seeking to be recognized for discussion? Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to follow up on Senator McKissick, Representative Reeves' request about the double bunking and everything, and just point out to the committee that someone tweeted out a report that was compiled. It looked like it was in September, showing which Superior Court judges and District Court judges were double bunked based on their voter registration address through the Board of Elections. And so if staff is compiling that and using the data from AOC, I hate for them to have to reinvent the wheel. They may want to make reference to that report. But
look for a tweet.
It's from NC Policy Watch. Oh. It is a list, and it has the judges' names and everything by district, showing their race and their sex. So you can tell how many women are double bunked, how many African Americans are double bunked. And if staff is compiling that information, they might want to consult that so they don't have to start from scratch.
Thank you, Representative. Anyone else? All right. Seeing no further hands, I think the committee's business for the day is done, and I don't know if it's been released. I think we're talking about a meeting for next Thursday, but I don't know if that's set yet. I'll just sort of make everybody put you on notice, and we'll get a notice out to you. We're adjourned. There are no maps. I mean, they got the House maps. It's the past.